Welcome, everybody, to the Wonder It All podcast. I'm Louis Schwartzberg, and I know a lot of you know me from the films I make, where I love to take audiences on journeys through time and scale, making the invisible visible, like Fantastic Fungi, where we went below the ground to explore nature's intelligence, and we brought that wisdom of connection and shared economies without greed above the ground as a model to live by, like we did with Gratitude Revealed. I love to combine the how of science and the why of art. And I always look at wonder and awe as that intersection between art and science. And this podcast is about having conversations with leaders who love to unveil that mystery. And what I've learned from filming for so many years is that immersing yourself in nature increases our capacity for courage, creativity, kindness, and compassion. And those are the components we need in order to heal our world, shift values, and our behavior. That's why I'm proud that today's podcast is supported by the Fetzer Institute. They are helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world. Uvini Lubecki, who's with us today, I'm so glad she's here, is an organizational consultant and a coach who's passionate about designing spiritual programs for secular audiences. She's worked with leaders from over 20 organizations like Macy's, Johnson & Johnson's, GoPro, Volvo, Department of Justice, and Google. And in 2017, she founded a Leading Through Connection, an organization focused on compassionate leadership. She currently brings her experience in spiritual innovation to the Sharing Spiritual Healing Institute at Fetzer, where she supports a learning cohort of spiritual innovators who are advancing spiritual innovation. She holds a bachelor's in neurobiology and behavior from Cornell University and a master's in public health from Harvard School of Public Health. In her free time, she writes young adult fantasy novels. She lives in San Francisco with her husband and her feral cat, Norbu. Uvini, so glad to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Louis. It's an honor to be here.
I know you've moved around a lot when you were growing up. I think you were born in Sri Lanka, and then you moved to New York and Nigeria. How did that influence your outlook on the world, and how do you view connections?
I think one of the things that occurred, because I never got to stay in any one place. So I was born in Sri Lanka, and I moved when I was two. Then we moved to upstate New York. So you can imagine, you know, from a tropical country to the snows and blizzards and Ithaca. And when I was six or seven, my father got a job at UNICEF. So that's why we moved to Nigeria. And that's really, I spent 6 years there and then Jordan. And what I think happened was that I never felt a sense of home in any particular place. Home was not a country. Home was not people who looked like me. Home really was something I had to create for myself. And in so doing, I feel that sometimes when people say, or they talk about things like belonging, it's hard to relate to because belonging for me is not something that comes externally. It comes kind of from an internal motivation to be with other people. And I would say also that belonging is not about how beyond a certain interest group. Like if you're in an interest group for fungi and you don't know anything about it, it might be a little bit hard to feel like you belong, although you could be interested. But I think belonging is about more about feeling welcomed more than it feels like there needs to be conditions in place for you to be a part of something. So that's one area that I feel that just belonging for me feels like I can do it anywhere. I feel like everyone is kind of a part of me, and I feel the most comfortable with people who don't look like me, actually, because when I go back to Sri Lanka, I don't look like them. I don't act like them. I laugh too loud. It's just a very different way of being, but I'm still Sri Lankan too. So it's this interesting thing around common humanity, I would say, where I feel like everyone's kind of my family in some way.
Growing up as a child and living in all those different places like Jordan and Nigeria, I mean, you probably saw a lot of suffering. And I know that as in a sense, an immigrant, and I'm like a, you know, first generation or second generation with my parents being Holocaust survivors, this feeling we have of, you know, patriotism in our country is really genuine, because we've seen how difficult it can be in other places. Can you share, like, how that has also shaped your worldview?
You know, I think one of the things that was interesting is that when I came to the United States, we were immigrants and, you know, living in grad school housing with, you know, with my brother. My father was doing psych tests to get the $50 or $20. It was a little bit difficult. But when we moved to Nigeria, I saw the relativeness of our own privilege. I was someone who was considered beautiful because of the color of my skin. And I was kind of elevated as, oh, wow, she's so beautiful. And then I moved to Jordan, and it was the opposite. I was considered not beautiful at all. In fact, at the lower end of the scale in Jordan, there's quite a bit of immigrants who come in who end up becoming service workers, so who work in homes as maids or and servants. So it's interesting that, I know this is a little bit different from your question around suffering, but I think what's coming to me is really how everything is so relative, that it's not, there's no absolute sense of beauty or no absolute sense of worth. And that was what the lesson was in going from these different places, that there was no one who could actually tell me anything about my worth or value, because it was changed everywhere I went. It was so conditional based on culture. So that was one aspect of the suffering. But the I would say the other aspect was, of course, seeing, you know, what you see in advertisements in the U.S. when you see a nonprofit ad, donate to Africa. I mean, little children, distended bellies, flies in their eyes, begging alongside their mothers. You know, while I'm going to school in a car, you know, with a driver, because that was the only safe way for us to go. It was a time of civilian unrest. The president had just been assassinated and foreigners were targeted. So the juxtaposition of privilege with extreme poverty was so great got me, ironically, because I'm doing compassion now, it got me to a very cynical place that, you know, if humans can do this to each other, you know, why is my father, who's not even from this country, helping out people who don't even treat each other well in their own country? Like, it was a very hard lesson of misunderstanding, of not knowing why we were doing this to each other.
I'm assuming this probably had an influence as to why you did a deep dive into Buddhism, which is about compassion. Can you tell me, like, how that influenced your journey and your relationship to Buddhism, and also, like, with your practice of Buddhism, how do you balance that with your research into science?
Yeah, it's interesting. My journey into Buddhism, I was raised Theravada Buddhist. My parents are pretty conservative practitioners. And, you know, so we did a lot of the ritualistic or ethical parts of it. And that was something that I didn't actually relate to. It didn't feel like quite like my home. And as I was going through these different aspects of moving from country to country and seeing these aspects of suffering, you know, the first truth of Buddhism is that, you know, there's suffering. It was very true. There was something I had to question. But my entry point didn't seem to be from these more ritualistic aspects or these ethical aspects. I really wanted to understand why. Why are we doing this? So my spiritual, I was always a seeker. I was always asking questions. I think that's why I went into neuroscience, because I wanted to understand mind and how the mind creates reality and our perception. And I couldn't find the answers I was looking for there. I felt it felt short. At some point, there's a limitation between how our brain works and consciousness itself. And so that didn't really answer anything for me. But I would say that the real entry point for Buddhism didn't come from seeing the suffering in Nigeria or seeing, you know, some of atrocities that in Jordan as well, particularly around honor killings and women being targeted there. It was really from a place of privilege that I saw my entry point. It was I was living in San Francisco. I had just moved. I was recently married. I had a loving husband. I was on a fast track to becoming a vice president in my company. So this was extraordinary at the age of 29. So I had everything that I thought I needed to be happy, and what I was told, you know, climb the ladder, keep your head down. And I was looking around me and I just felt absolutely miserable. It was, I couldn't point to anything externally in my life. It was an existential crisis. We call it a spiritual crisis. I couldn't find a sense of meaning. What is this? I'm just going to grow old, have babies and die. Like, what is this? Like, what? Just keep going on this treadmill. So that sense of misery, not having an answer from what society was telling me was the answer, was really the time I started to look elsewhere and within. I met a gentleman who was at a conference I was at, the Quantified Health Conference. So this is back in the day before we were measuring everything. It was this innovative concept that we were going to measure our sleep, our poop, our everything. So, and he came into this conference and he said, I want to understand how to measure group behavior. I get that we can measure individual behavior, but how do we think about measuring group dynamics? And the person leading it said, why do you want to do that? He said, well, I spend 6 months out of the year in a monastery. And these monks are extraordinary. They can memorize hundreds of pages a day, but not just memorize, but debate them. And I want to understand what they're doing. How are they doing this? And I don't know why, but the words monastery and monks and a foreigner, you know, he's from California, a white man, going into a Tibetan colony and studying with them, suddenly just, it just sparked some interest. And that's really, you know, I would say 2 months later, I was on a flight to India with a retreat with the Dalai Lama, and that was it. It was, And was nature for you the same? Was it nature that brought you into your spiritual journey, or was there something before that? I mean, your parents' histories.
Definitely, I think it was nature where I first felt a connection that everything is one, and feeling small in a grand universe. You know, being raised in a Jewish household, not extremely, you know, Orthodox, but that, you know, went to Sunday school, but I never had the feeling of it. It was like, these are the right things to do, like the Ten Commandments. Can't argue with that. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Those are good things to live by. But I never felt it. I never felt immersed in it. And it was only in college when I started to, you know, discover photography and filmmaking and be outdoors and alone in nature that I was able to, like, you know, have that ego disillusion and feel one. And that idea of the oneness, and also I think compassion for every little critter and plant, that's another, you know, wonderful feeling of what I guess Buddhism and many religions talk about is compassion. And if you can feel that in relation, when everything is like, quote unquote, in relationship to the trees and plants, which I continue to do. Today, I got cameras going nonstop, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, shooting, you know, flowers, plants, guy, because they're my cousins. And I want to be able to see how they dance to the light. So that's something that, you know, gets me up out of bed every morning. That's what I enjoy doing. So I'm curious, like, this relationship, which seems to be key to your studies and practice. You've done a deep dive into this idea about connection. And we just came out of this serious thing called the pandemic, where we learned that disconnection is the hardest thing we had to deal with, other than the people who obviously got sick and had and lost loved ones. But this idea of not having, you know, your friends and family over, not being able to go to dinner, things we took for granted. Take us on a deep dive into what you are exploring and learning about connection.
I think I'll start with a little bit about the word connection, because it brings up so many different forms. And I think you can form a connection with someone even across the room who's at a coffee shop and not say a single word. And you can also form a connection like this, where we get to talk about matters that we care deeply about and that feels meaningful. So there's many different forms of connection. There's no, I would say, right at the right outset, there's no type that it looks like. So connection for me is.
And actually, I'm sorry, but you're in San Francisco and not LA in the moment. Yeah. And we're having a form of connection, but go on.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's no real restriction from external parameters that, or conditions that say this is what connection looks like. I think it's an experiential thing, something that all sentient beings, even animals, can feel, I think. And when I boil that down, when I think about what connection is composed of, there's three aspects that come to mind. And the first aspect is just being present. Just this level of simplistic awareness. And I know this is something that we use all the time now in everyday language, being present. So I don't think it's anything new, but there's a nuance to that, where that presence itself can be trusted. That it's not the thoughts flowing through my head or the emotions going in my body, but just being with you itself is this extraordinary form of connection. So it starts there, because you're not thinking about the past, you're not thinking about the future, you're not relating to what someone's saying with the story, you're right here with me. And so just like that, it's that fast, even over Zoom. We're not using Zoom, we're using something wonderful here, but yes, that can happen. And then the second part is this idea of caring. And caring is sometimes a loaded word, especially when we feel like that's something that we have to do. Like, I have to care about you. And instead, the way that I think about caring is a little bit more innate and natural, that it comes through the presence. Exactly what you said, when you're with a mushroom or a tree or anything, and you're completely present, out of that comes this tenderness. You use the word compassion. That's the same word I use. But it's a sense of caring, right? It's not caring because I have to care or they did something for me, or it's just because you're together and you're, yeah, that's it. It just happens. So that's the caring I'm talking about. And that moves away a kind of a moralistic or dogmatic approach, where it's like, we have to care about everybody because we're in this together. It's just in us always. But we lose sight of that when we're filled with our noise. And that's why the presence comes first, in order for the caring to just open. And the second part about caring, I would say, is that in working with leaders, particularly around connection, the biggest unlocking, the key that unlocks caring, is really self-compassion. That's the secret. It's this sort of unconditional self-acceptance. Because when we accept ourselves so completely, we can actually be there. We can be there for someone else. You're not wondering like, oh, how am I looking right now? What am I doing? How am I saying? You know, you're not in here. You're out. You're everywhere. So self-compassion is really the heart of connection, ironically.
For me, maybe some other people, that could be the hardest part, because it's easy to be self-critical, especially if you're a perfectionist like I am and other things. But yeah, I think that's a really good point. To be easy on yourself, to be kind to yourself.
Yeah, Yeah, it's when we're gentle to ourselves, then we can appreciate when other people aren't gentle to themselves, and then that caring just comes. It's like, oh man, I've been there.
Yeah. And even to forgive yourself is really hard to do.
Yeah, that's a whole. Have you figured that out?
No, I think it's the ultimate form of love or compassion is to be able to forgive yourself. Seems like it's easier to forgive others than it is to forgive yourself, you know? But go on. So those are the three aspects of connection that you are exploring.
Awareness, caring, and then the third would be some action that you take. Either that's to say something, to look, because it's hard to connect or for the other, you know, for us to touch in together. I can sit here and feel all good, but it's not always easy for you to know that. So it's nice to kind of move in into some. So that would be the third aspect. But I would say the third aspect is just emergent. It's spontaneous from the first two. So the first two really are the core aspects of connection.
Let me ask you, like with the work you're currently doing, it's certainly different than what you were doing working with, let's say, corporate leaders in bigger companies. What made you decide to shift away from that?
I felt a sense of, because I ran away from corporate thinking that was the problem. And I felt after I had discovered these amazing practices that could be applied anywhere, I initially wanted to go back and to work with people I knew were struggling with the same pain I had, but I did not have the tools. So that's what brought me into the corporate area, and also to know that these tools could be so transformative for folks who are making key decisions about our lives. Even if you're a product manager, we're talking about privacy and security and all kinds of issues that we all interact with. And so if these tools could be used, I felt that they could naturally flow into the work as well. So those were the two motivations for going into corporate. As I'm seeing the shift in my own practice as well, I'm hungering to sort of going deeper on a more personal level, and also one of my main teachers is the Dalai Lama, and he just spoke recently at the Mind and Life conference around ethics, morality in the future, and how to live a happy life. And one of the things that struck me, he said, was that, you know, this planet is burning. And he said something that deeply hit me, which he said, we have 200 years left. And he repeated this three times. And when we think about that, I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means left for humanity, left for what. But he said, we must be one human family. We can't focus on our differences. We have 200 years left. It was such a wake-up call to shift our priorities to thinking about our next generation, what we're leaving behind, and also, I would say, the Gen Z millennials out there who are inheriting this. And so he strongly advocated for compassionate leadership, particularly for young people. And that I took that in, and I started to think about how do I listen? Not how do I bring this program to young people, but really first, how do I listen to young leaders who are going to inherit this planet and who are going to shape how it will go, how we will flow as a human race, and to listen to them. What does compassion mean to you? What does compassionate leadership look like to you? So that's really why I started to shift. So I'm starting to look at that in my personal work. And also, as you mentioned, in spiritual innovation. So there's a host of spiritual leaders out there who are just reimagining how religion and traditional practices can be brought forward in today's world. So that's another area of interest. as well. So I'm just kind of moving with what feels like it's very important. And I felt like I kind of, I don't know if I did what I had to do, but I felt like I went back. I didn't just run away.
Yeah. Well, your journey, who knows? Hopefully, you know, maybe you will circle back, because people who are CEOs of big corporations are influential, and they can, you know, we need to touch everybody, you know, and everyone's values can be shifted in a positive way, which in the net result is it changes behavior. You change behavior, it's a way to, you know, create communities, and actually it creates movements in that regard as well, you know. So I know, like, Fetzer did a study. I think they were looking at, like, you know, because of the polarization in our country, you know, like, when people go to church, do they consider that a political organization or not? And actually it is political, because you sort of end up going to a group of people that are like-minded, you know, and therefore you end up, like, you know, perhaps voting in a certain way as a block, you know. So you may not think going to church is a political action at all, but indirectly it can be. And certainly when you hang out with your friends and you talk about, you know, like what you're discussing, you know, what, where are we going the next generation or 200 years out? In those conversations, it ends up perhaps leading people to make choices. Those choices, you know, can affect the environment on our planet, you know? You drive like an electric car, the choices you make about the food you eat, all those, you know, add up to something really giant and is a significant effect on the planet. So, yeah, so this idea of connection and community could be perhaps the most important solution we're looking for. Let me ask you, what is your definition of gratitude?
Definition of gratitude. It's hard to put into words, but all I feel is love. I know there's more to gratitude than just love. It's, I guess it's remembering.
Maybe not. Well, maybe not. I mean, there's also, you know, is it a trite saying that, you know, it's all about love, you know? It's the most powerful force in the universe. So if that's what you're feeling, maybe that is everything.
I guess gratitude is like the spark of remembering and the love that follows. The Dalai Lama recently did a conference for the Mind and Life Institute. And the topic was morality, ethics, and how to live a happy life for the future. And I think the thing that struck me was that he kept repeating again and again, even interrupting the scientists in the room. He said, we have 200 years left. We have to think about our human oneness, not our differences. We must come together with our oneness. We have 200 years left. And when I heard that, something in my heart broke. I don't know what that means, and I don't know if that means that's for humanity or for this earth, but as my teacher, I sort of trust his guidance. And so that's what really sparked this idea for me to shift away from what I was doing in the corporate world and start to look at what's actually critical and urgent right now. And what he said was important was to bring some of these practices, compassionate leadership, particularly to young people. And I thought, well, I have this curriculum. I'm sort of invested in this field. I'd love to go and explore this with young people, millennials, Gen Z, who are inheriting this planet and who will be stewarding it forward. And not in a way where I feel like I have to bring my curriculum to them, but rather to be in dialogue and inquiry and say, what does compassion mean to you? what does new forms of leadership look like for you, unburdened by the patterns that we've cultivated and that we think are norms, but really from a generation that's looking at this planet with maybe a finite end to all things, all beings. So that really struck me. And I think that just started to, I just listened to that, and that was part of my motivation for shifting. And in addition, as you mentioned in the intro, also looking at spiritual innovation, and that's the heart of it, right? It's to bring religion out of these boxes and this vocabulary into areas where people can access it in their own way. And so that's why I'm also passionate about bringing spiritual programs to secular audiences, to sort of open it up. This is all around us, so.
What are some practices that you could suggest for people to, you know, dive into in order to accomplish that?
I can only speak from my experience, and I think everyone has their unique path. So I will just speak what has worked for me, and maybe it will work for others. But I remember, you know, everybody knows about meditation, and I remember when I started to meditate, I've been doing it for, I think, 5 or 6 years at that point. And I was still pretty miserable and depressed. There was a lot of lightning of my sort of mental load, and I felt peaceful and calm. But when I went back out into reality, I still felt this sort of overlay of depression. And I was in India, and I had the fortune to be with one of my root teacher, Mingyur Rinpoche. And I just attended a retreat with him, and we were at the airport together. So his flight was delayed, and I saw this stream of students going by, and I was kind of mustering the courage to go up to him. And I finally did, and I said, Mingyur Rinpoche, I've been practicing meditation for 5 to 6 years now, and I still feel really depressed. What should I do? What am I doing wrong? And, you know, I just sat there waiting for like this a magical pith instruction, you know. Like, and you know what he told me? He said, okay, every morning, write down 5 things you're grateful for and make a list. And the next morning, do it again for at least a month. Just do that. And I was so disappointed. I was like, really? That's it? I wanted something like that's just like a magic pill, like focus on that and it'll be great. But no, really, that was what he told me. And so I went back and I actually did it. I you know, and he said it doesn't have to be these big things, you know, it could just be, you know, I'm grateful that I can see. I'm grateful that I'm breathing. I'm grateful for the food, you know, just small things. And it was this extraordinary shift at this small practice of writing down what I was grateful for could shift my worldview to the extent that it just became thinner and thinner, and this kind of veil. And later on, I understood, you know, what you point your mind towards is the perception of that's the reality you create. You think about negative things, that's what you see. And so that small practice is one that I think related to gratitude, I think what brings us together, yeah. But truly one of extraordinary practice.
I do the same thing. I found out that being grateful for the little things, which I really kind of learned from my parents who appreciated all the little things in life, given what they had gone through, you know, like a food on the table, a roof over their head, a steady job, having children, all represented heaven on earth to them. And so now I understand too, if I find myself going into a negative spiral, that I think of something really simple that I can be grateful for. You know, the fact that I'm breathing, the fact that I can walk. I mean, it's so easy to pull something out of your pocket. And without being a neuroscientist, I've discovered you can't be thinking a negative thought and a positive thought at the same time. It's either one or the other. So you know, just by going positive for a beat, I'm stopping the energy flow or the neural pathway going negative. And at least it puts it on pause. Doesn't mean I resolved that negative issue, but I paused it. And now I'm in this other world of what I'm grateful for. And that enables me to kind of regain some balance, you know, and figure out, like, you know, what I need to do. And you know, studies have shown that people who do write down five things, I believe it was at UCSD cardiology department, there was an improvement in people with heart disease, and that they were able to, like, recover faster. And so therefore, there's really some hardcore science that proves that there's a benefit to it. And you're right, it really is a simple act. And then I think in addition, yeah, I just wanted to share that you don't have to be like a filmmaker or a photographer to appreciate beauty. Like, that's one thing I can always do. I can be in an alley and find beauty. It can be, you know, a crack in the asphalt that looks like a tree. It could be a garbage can. It could be a fire hydrant. Or it could be a tree, you know. And if you can just, like, stop for a moment and not intellectualize why you are attracted to it, but just to feel it, that is a way to nourish your soul. And that becomes a practice where every time I go on a walk, again, without a camera, and I notice, like, the light bouncing off a leaf, or I notice, you know, a reflection in the gutter, that's enough to, you know, feed my soul.
Oh, beautiful practice. Yeah. Yeah, you're making me think also of another very powerful practice, also backed by scientific studies, is the practice of just labeling. So when you're in emotion, just the act of saying "I'm angry" takes you out of the emotion. So just labeling, it creates a gap because you're no longer in it. If you can see it, you're not in it.
Right. So
just that label, "I'm angry," it doesn't have to be out loud. It could be internally, or "I'm nervous." Suddenly you're seeing the nervousness, and you're beyond the nervousness, but the nervousness doesn't have to go away. So the labeling aspect is another quick practice you can have, particularly during an emotional episode. I think it was Lieberman.
That's a great little device to have. It's nice having these little things in your back pocket, you know, that you can, like, you know, use no matter where you are, in whatever situation you are, you know. So can you share with me a moment you've had where you felt wonder and awe?
I knew we were going to talk about wonder and awe at some point. So I really tried to think about the moments that really brought me to a sense of just complete, just awe, where you stand still. And I think the deepest one was when I felt for the first time that I had the capacity to not suffer. It was just like this, like this extraordinary possibility that there was some capacity, ability at any point in time to not suffer. And with that came extraordinary gratitude too. I really think, well, awe and gratitude are so connected in that way. Because those moments, that moment particularly, when I sort of understood, I got what I was trying to do in my spiritual journey for so long, it came with this extraordinary level of gratitude and awe that it's actually a choice. It's a choice that I suffer, and that there's always a possibility to not. And that to me is why I think there is a something beyond. That is the sort, if we think about spirituality as something intangible or immaterial or whatever you want to call it, it doesn't have to be God, but just this capacity to know that you're not stuck in what we think we are, in who we think we are, but there's this capacity to not have to suffer. Like that brought me to awe. I mean, there's many moments looking at an ocean and being with someone and feeling that just amazing, oh, wow, you're so extraordinary. Like you're, you know, that those are wonderful aspects. But I think the one that really sticks was that moment, because that was the start of my true spiritual path.
Yeah. Yeah. You ever have little smaller moments of wonder and awe, you know, that delight you?
Oh, yeah.
You in a good way?
Oh, yeah. My feral cat, Norbu, is a source of extraordinary delight and awe. She's my spiritual teacher as well. I mean, she's very patient. She's relaxed. She reminds me that really in this world, there's really not much for us to do than sleep, eat, and poop. Like, we make up a whole bunch of complexity on top of that, but really, so just life is okay. So she brings a lot of delight, just like her pawing with something or climbing a tree, or I think the warmth of the sun on my skin, sitting outside. I'm a big audiophile, so just any music that, yeah, it's really ordinary things, but if I pay attention, they just become the source of awe.
And I mean, pets or animals are great because they are in the present moment. They're always in the present moment. Like my dog, I mean, what's 1 inch away from his nose is the universe. That's it. There's nothing else. You know, when they're walking, they got their nose down and they're just sniffing the ground. And it's like, they're so present. And then they'll just quickly, like, he'll turn his head and, what did I smell? Oh, what was that? And it's like, he's just absorbing. He's not thinking about, you know, where I need to be, past or present, but definitely in the moment. Mm. And I think that's what we're all trying to do. I think for me, wonder and awe is that, you know, intersection where you become present. And when you become present, because of the beauty and the wonder that grabs your sensual, that grabs your senses, you know, and it creates a sensual experience. Like looking at a flower, you know, there's the aroma, there's the color, there's the pattern. And then there's the awareness that, like, the bee on the flower is creating, you know, a transportation method for DNA to be moved around, which gives us the fruits, nuts, and berries we need to eat. So you have this deeper appreciation, which engenders gratitude, you know, that what I'm observing is like a keystone event that gives us the food that we need to eat. So it's beautiful, you know, just visually and in a very sensory way, but it's also supporting life on our planet. And that adds like a whole other layer of gratitude.
And I think you mentioned to me earlier that there is a point when you were doing that and it felt like you weren't, it wasn't you looking at the bee per se. It was sort of like this togetherness in it.
Well, I think when you become present, then you are one with whatever it is you're observing. And you don't have that sense of other. And it's a joy to be able to become a lizard or a bee or a bug or a flower for a moment. You know, it's not like a real conscious thing, like I'm a flower. It's more like my awareness is 100% there. And I'm not thinking about that I'm looking at a flower. I'm just, you know, there. And in a way, I think that's probably the way, like on weekends, I'm gardening all day long because they are, you know, communicating with me what their needs are, you know, that they need to be watered or, you know, fertilized and moved and trimmed and pruned. And it's a constant maintenance that is a joy. and they don't speak to me, but I have messages that are coming to me, and it's fun to take care of them. And it goes back to what you said about caring. You know, I'm caring for them. I'm a slave to them in a good way. And all day, you know, the whole day goes by and I'm happy. I haven't been doing a lot of intellectual, you know, thinking, which is good. You know, I'm just a caregiver for plants in the garden for a day.
And it's spontaneous. It just sort of, you're just there. Yeah. Sort of like a cup falls and you just go. Yeah.
And it's never ending. So the narrative is really beautiful because I don't know what's going to come up next. You know, I'm going to, you know, solve that problem. And then I'm going to fix that thing. And then as I'm walking, I notice that guy needs help. And this thing needs help. And that needs to be. And it's just like, it just unfolds. It's like one of the things I really love. My favorite thing in being outdoors is like snorkeling with, like, you know, sea turtles. Where you, like, you follow, you know, the turtle. And you follow a fish. And you follow a reef. It's like, as a filmmaker, it's like a more non-narrative movie. It just, everything just unfolds as it should. And it makes you very present because we let go of the old fashioned storytelling of act one, act two, act three, you know, of the drama of conflict, which I don't believe in. I think we need a new story. Like the things I do on Netflix, like Moving Art, of just visuals with music and no narration. I've gotten, you know, hundreds of comments where people claim it heals them. I've never claimed it's a healing modality, but it's a wonderful example of how people can go on their own personal journey, which for me is really what spirituality should be, that there isn't, you know, a one God. There isn't a one religion. Everyone should have their own spiritual path that they discover on their own, because that's what you're supposed to do. That's what I think your mission on this planet is, to figure that out. Like, what is your mission? What are you here to, you know, contribute somehow? What are you trying to discover? What are you looking to explore? And hopefully, like, healing the planet at the same time, you know, that whatever you're doing, there's a benefit to that. But you got to figure it out for yourself. Just like when you sat down with your meditation guru at the airport, he didn't give you the silver bullet. He told you to figure it out for yourself. You know? And if we can relax into the mystery, that there is no answer, and that is the answer, and I'm cool with that answer, you know, then it would eliminate a lot of strife and war on a planet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm a big believer in personal transformation being the seat of, or the response or answer to world transformation. It's the inner and the outer reflection. And there is no spiritual path outside of your own. Because no one can do it for you. And sometimes that feels like a little overwhelming, but I think for me, it feels like confidence inducing. But you get to be the director of your journey. No one else gets to tell you. They can advise you and give you guide points, but ultimately it's up to you, right? As to how to go. And it's beautiful. I found that just watching the slow, the unfolding of the mushrooms and fantastic fungi, moments of extraordinary connection to the earth and the planet and compassion for it. And it was beautiful. But to your point about modalities being healing in ways that you don't anticipate, but I think it comes from your presence. Like if it wasn't there, the source of that couldn't have touched me. So that's where the connection comes to, where your presence elicits my presence. One thing that did come to mind for me when we were talking about presence, and especially with the animal, and it being present, like, I think what you're describing when you're saying this oneness with the bee, but you're not the bee, but you're not other than the bee, is distinct form of presence than object subject duality presence, where you can, like, where an animal is just directed, it's kind of, it's being led by external environments, and this level of presence that humans particularly have, which is this, what scientific studies call it, meta-awareness, like ability to be aware that you're aware, that you're not in the river of just whatever's next, is a distinct difference that is our gift and our opportunity as human beings, and why we have this responsibility, I would even call it a moral responsibility, because of this gift, to not ruin it for those who don't have that possibility yet. Because in my belief system, everybody's a Buddha, even my cat is a Buddha. But the cat is far harder for my cat to recognize that it's a Buddha than a human being can, because we have this function of thought. So I just wanted to name that, because I think what you're tapping into is the reason why your films has that response from your viewers. It's not just someone studying kind of from a distant thing, right? It's someone who's deeply, well, I'm just putting my words in you, but this is what I'm receiving. It's like someone who's deeply with, being with something. And that's a different type of presence than what we conventionally talk about when we're saying being present.
No, I appreciate that. I do. I'm not the creator of the phenomena. I think one of the things I do that breaks that barrier of awareness is because I do manipulate time and scale. I show you things that are real, that are beyond, let's say, human perception, you know, by watching, you know, speeding up time, quote unquote, a flower opens up, or slowing it down to see a hummingbird or a bee. I'm showing you reality, and that opens up your worldview, because just because the limitations of human perception doesn't mean that is the entire universe. You are living in a narrow bandwidth of perception, and other animals and other living things and even minerals and mountains have a different ability to perceive reality, which is what you're studying, which is really fascinating. And so it's really for those people that can lean into being open-minded, that can lean into the mystery. And then you're seeing the mushrooms, as you said, it really touched you. Well, because you realized that you just saw something that was a gift. It's a gift because you just saw what life is like, maybe from a mushroom point of view, you know? And therefore, how enlightening that is for you to be able to step, just like going to India, you're able to see life from what it's like to live in that culture, how enlightening that is to you and your life and how you treat others. If you only lived in your neighborhood in one country, you know, that would be a very limited point of view, obviously. So being able to expand the horizon is spiritual in that way. And I'm happy that I'm able to, like, you know, to do that, because it's a joy for me. And I am aware that what I am doing isn't just scientifically interesting, you know, to be able to say, wow, did you know that flowers can move and grow? And here's what they do. And it's more about the magic of it, you know, the wonder of it. The beauty of it, and why does it touch your heart, and why does it create an emotion, and can we live in that space a little longer than a moment, like, you know, taking a moment to smell the roses, like, you know, it's not something, it's not a 1 second experience, it's more like, can you, like, savor it and I'm sure you know, in science, we're hardwired to dwell on the negative, because of the survival instinct, all that, and you know, and fear. But when happiness occurs, when good things happen, we tend to quickly go back to the problem solving part of the brain. You know, okay, we'll fix this, fix that, and we don't nourish and cherish and savor the good stuff, you know, which I have to learn how to do, by the way, to be in that moment longer, not like, oh, that's good news. Oh, really? Oh, great. Moving on. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, great. I mean, we kind of skip through it, you know, we hurry through the goodness that is, you know, part of our lives, and go back to the linear functional aspect, which takes over our lives.
Yes. Oh, so much that's coming up for me. But I think the one thing that I feel that you're tapping into, and which I can relate to from the work that I do, is that you're tapping into something universal. Like, this is something primally encoded in all of us to be able to cherish that experience. It's not something where I have to be interested in mushrooms to be able to revel in seeing that. And I think one thing, particularly in our time, that we are focused on is our differences, either from our skin color or from our, you know, race, ethnicity, status, political orientation, what have you. And this orientation around our differences skips over the exact same quality we have with other human beings as what you can elicit with the mushroom, you know, is this universal quality of connection that just goes so much deeper than all of these stories that we've crafted on top of how we look or feel or are or think about things. And I just really feel so strongly about that, because it's such a possibility that if we can tap into that experientially, not just through science and data, that's helpful for our intellectual mind to feel comforted and it's not just someone's idea, but if we can experience that even just for a moment, and maybe that's why I'm in this work, because I'm an international mutt. You know, my favorite TV shows are Korean. I'm married to a Polish man. I'm from Sri Lanka. I'm practicing Tibetan Buddhism in America. I lived everywhere. I don't see differences in the same way, but maybe that's just why I'm so passionate about it and why I believe. I don't have to believe in it. I trust it. But for that just one moment, when you're talking about resonance or frequency, that you feel that, it just breaks apart all of this nonsense that we separate each other from and creates something just so fun and magical and playful and possible and creative, everything. So yes, the mushroom and the humans and everybody around us has that possibility.
This is like, you know, something that's worthy of a lot of exploration and a ton of conversation. What we mean by universal, you know? And it's like, if I film something, it isn't just beautiful for me, and I don't just have a gift of knowing what's beautiful for everybody. I'm tapping into a universal truth and pattern and rhythm that is inside of all of us. Just like you said, there's that Buddha nature in all of us. And in all the different cultures that you've experienced, there is a shared universal truth. And no one ever taught us what that is. We didn't go to school to learn universal truth. We never went to school to learn about universal beauty. It's inside of all of us, right? And so if I tap into it, again, I don't feel like, oh, I'm the auteur, artist who created something that touches a lot of people. What I am is really a conduit and a messenger that opened up a window into something that touches your heart, you know? And that's my gift, is to be that conduit. And that makes me feel good, because I'm sharing, you know, that, and I'm creating connection. And to me, it's really fascinating. So whether it's in nature or whether it's in culture, you know, it doesn't matter. When we tap into what is universal, you know, that is the ultimate connection.
Yes. Yeah. And when I think of universal, I think of the word as well, innate, not something we need to cultivate, like not something we have to achieve, it's already here. It just is not recognized, or it's not, there is some cultivation. So, you know, we have innate sense of compassion, but for 10,000 years as human beings, we lived in tribes of 150 people or less. So these were folks that we knew intimately. They knew ordinary names, or grandparents, or grandparents' grandparents. So those were circles of trust. And for a long time, those were the tribes we lived in. And so we haven't developed the muscle to move beyond that. Now we're in an era where we're working across cultures. We're in a globalized society. And wherever we are, we're always interacting with people who are different, who look different from us. So there is extraordinary practices and tools to help us sort of cultivate that innate part. So I'm not saying that it's innate and then that's it, because like it took discipline and commitment for hours and hours of time to be filming those things. And I think it's faster because there's social animals on the human front when we're trying to have these tools. But I guess one thing that I think gets misunderstood, particularly in my work when I'm starting to talk about compassion, is that people have a lot of rigidity. They're like, oh, are you going to tell me I'm not compassionate enough? Because they're so fearful that that's the case. But in reality, the whole thing is really self-compassion, because what's preventing us from being together is really just our own self-hatred in a lot of ways, or lack of self-acceptance. Because once that goes away, we're clear conduits. And sometimes maybe that's easier in nature or with an animal. Like we can be so loving to animals because that conduit is open. But when we're with other people, it's harder. It's just the projections of our mind that we see all the unresolved things within ourselves. So I don't know where I'm going with that, but I think what I'm saying is that the universal and innate quality, and with tools, there's possibility for not suffering, to be happy. I mean, that's the whole point of all this, isn't it? I mean,
it is. And it's kind of surprising that in this particular day and age, you know, with this, the data, in this day and age, the data we hear that young people are have more depression, that there's more suicide. It's surprising because in a way there generally is less, you know, disease and starvation around the planet. Mm-hmm. And it's like all the constructs that surround us have created an inability to touch what is universal, to touch the Buddha inside of you, you know, and it's getting harder and harder to unleash it or to uncover it. It is inside of all of us. You know, that's a fact. I believe that. And I believe everybody is, you know, innate, like you say, it's innate in all of us. And so, we just got to find more modalities to tap into it. You know, music, art, going in nature, you know, the groups that you're creating, the work that Fetzer does, all of these are beautiful pathways to really kind of crack through that construct on the outside that makes us think who we are.
Yeah, I completely agree. All of these are access points. All of these are conduits, and we pick up the ones that we're interested in. And I would love a world where spirituality and the word spiritual is a norm in all places. It's something in education, it's something in organizations, it's something in businesses, it's something in military organizations, where we don't deny that very core aspect, because the more we're separate from it, the more, as you're saying, we fall into these mental states, that, because we're just separating ourselves from ourselves. Right. When we go into these areas and we deny who we are. So I would hope that through your work and through things like this, that it just becomes commonplace, that it's natural. It's a natural thing to consider the spiritual dimension, even in a meeting about, I don't know, acorns and I don't know why acorns came to mind, but
it starts with the letter A.
It starts with the letter A.
It's the product. Top of the list of things we can talk about.
Ketchup. There we go.
Well, this has been like a wonderful journey and conversation to, you know, look, we come to this world alone and we leave alone, mm-hmm. you know, and we die. And so it's like the journey into oneself and the journey into what is spiritual is trying to answer that big question. Where did we come from? Where are we going? And in between all that is something called life, you know, and just like a lot of confusion and in all of that, perhaps, you know, and I think we're all trying to get back to that core, innate, universal, spiritual seat of knowledge and wisdom and comfort.
Yeah, well said. Thank you so much, Louis, for this and for the opportunity to talk.
So let's tap into it. Let's just keep on tapping into it and nurturing it when we find it. Not easy, you know, to navigate that. And I wanted to thank you for all the great work you're doing. I know you are inspiration to young people and especially women who are, you know, breaking barriers and being leaders. And I think it's wonderful to have this younger generation, younger than mine, I would say, really be focused on the fact that this is important, maybe the most important thing we do, and to be able to understand that and nurture it and care for it and develop it and be happy in doing it. It's not a job. Like, you don't have to meditate. I don't have to go to church. I don't have to, you know, the to-do list thing. It's something that you just can fall into naturally. You go on a walk around the block, you'll feel it. You know, you pet your little kitty cat, you'll feel it. Anytime you feel it, just hang with it and enjoy it.
Oh, so well said. And I think I'm so grateful to be here. And I think the only thing that I would add is that we don't have to suffer. Like, we have tools, we have practices, and we have everything we already need. So that's what keeps me going, that we just don't have to suffer, and everybody has the possibility to not do that. That just, it's just unnecessary. So,
well, thank you so much for this conversation. And I want to be able to thank my team at Moving Art and all the change makers that are out there that are, you know, trying to make this world better for us and for generations to come. And we'll continue this conversation, okay?
Yes, thank you, Louis.
All right, thank you. Brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world.